Case number 23-5036. Samar Jose Lopez Bello, appellant, versus Andrea M. Gackey in her official capacity as Director of the Office of Foreign Assets Control and United States Department of the Treasury, Office of Foreign Assets Control. Mr. Ferrari for the appellant, Mr. Schultz for the appellees.
Good morning, counsel. Mr. Ferrari, please proceed when you're ready.
Good morning, Your Honors. It may please the court. Eric Ferrari for the appellant, Samar Jose Lopez Bello. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my time for rebuttal. Your Honors, there are three issues in this matter. Whether the Office of Foreign Assets Control can, under the Kingpin Act, designate a Tier 2 narcotics trafficker designee for providing assistance or acting on behalf of a Tier 1 designee at the time that the Tier 1 designee was not yet designated as such. Two, if that interpretation is permissible, whether it would be consistent with due process fair notice obligations. And three, whether the disclosures that the appellees have made to the appellant as to the reasons for his Tier 2 designation are adequate to provide the who, where, what, and when of the allegations, such to give him a meaningful opportunity to respond to the agency's action. Your Honors, the Foreign Narcotics Kingpin Designation Act authorizes the President and the Secretary of the Treasury to impose economic sanctions on two tiers of persons, Tier 1 narcotics traffickers and Tier 2 narcotics traffickers. Under Tier 1, there are two categories of persons who can be sanctioned as Tier 1. There are significant foreign narcotics traffickers, which are publicly identified by the President and in reports to Congress. And there are foreign persons that are designated by the Secretary of the Treasury for playing a significant role in international narcotics trafficking. The Tier 2 category of designations is also broken down into two separate categories. You have foreign persons who provide material assistance, support, or services in connection with the narcotics trafficking activities of those significant foreign narcotics traffickers so identified in reports submitted to Congress under the Act, or foreign persons designated by the Secretary pursuant to the Kingpin Act, as well as foreign persons acting for or providing assistance to such persons. Now, Mr. Lopez, the appellant here, was designated as a Tier 2 designee for providing support or services to Tarek El Asami, a Tier 1 designee who was designated simultaneously with Mr. Lopez. And as such, the activities which purportedly led to Mr. Lopez's designation were carried out with a person who was not yet designated under the Kingpin Act at the time that those purported acts occurred. So the first issue here is whether the appellees have the statutory authority to designate Tier 2 designees in connection with their acts or assistance to a person will later become designated as a Tier 1 designee. When reviewing the text and the history and the structure and the purpose of the Kingpin Act, appellant's reading of the statute that a Tier 2 designee cannot be designated for providing assistance or acting on behalf of a Tier 1 designee if that Tier 1 designee has not yet been sanctioned is the only correct reading. First, the language of the Tier 2 designation criteria is plain. It uses the words regarding this designation criteria for Tier 2s that those acts have to be on behalf of a person designated by the Secretary of the Treasury pursuant to the Kingpin Act, or so identified as a significant foreign narcotics trafficker. And the reading becomes even more plain when you read it that way, because what the appellees are suggesting is that the Tier 2 criteria applies to persons who provided support or services to a person who could later become sanctioned under the Kingpin Act. But that wouldn't make sense for a variety of reasons. Number one, it would render that derivative designation criteria to be superfluous. Because if a person can already be designated for engaging in international narcotics trafficking activities, then the appropriate way to designate them would to be under that Tier 1 criteria for doing so, not just because they're involved in international narcotics trafficking alongside another person who could later become designated as such. Second, and we cited this in our briefs, the legislative history supports our interpretation. The House report with respect to the Kingpin Act was notes that Congress was styling this statute pursuant to what the executive had done in the Columbia IEPA-based executive order, Executive Order 12978, which imposed sanctions on foreign firms or individuals that assist or provide support to the narcotics trafficking activities of named drug kingpins or other already designated narcotics traffickers. And the House report also notes that in implementing that program, OFAC would identify and research foreign targets that can be linked by evidence to individuals or entities already designated pursuant to the order. The district court did not discuss this legislative history at all or distinguish why it was not relevant to represent Congress's intent. And again, I go back to this point about the designation criteria for the Tier 2 designees becoming superfluous, because once you look at the structure of the Kingpin Act, it makes a lot more sense. Those parties who are the drug kingpins can be named under 1904B1. The major traffickers who are involved in narcotics trafficking activities will be designated under B4. And then once such persons have been designated, the public is on notice that if they do business with such designated persons, they themselves could be sanctioned. And that—
In terms of notice, if you're a person who's doing Tier 2 kind of activities, you have notice that the person you're dealing with may be designated as a Tier 1 designee. I mean, that designation may not have happened yet, but you're assuming the risk because you know that person is within the crosshairs of the statute and they may become designated. So I don't know that the notice argument carries a lot of weight when you're on notice that you're engaging in activity that puts you at risk of being designated.
And may I add to the chief's statement, it also puts you at risk of being indicted and convicted of a federal criminal offense.
Well, what I would say to those points, Your Honors, is that the designation criteria for the Tier 2 traffickers doesn't have any knowing requirement. And so really, when Congress was drafting this, they were trying to ensure that people who might be dealing with parties whom they do not know to be involved in narcotics trafficking are not swept into the coverage of the act by those acts until such time as such persons are identified. And to both your point, Judge Srinivasa and Judge Randolph, those persons who are involved in international narcotics trafficking could be designated as Tier 1 designees themselves. Indeed, the definition of narcotics trafficking under the statute at 21 U.S.C. 1907-3 indicates clearly that those activities cover those who aid, abet, collude, or conspire with others to engage in narcotics trafficking activities. So what we're saying is not that persons who are participating in the activities of international narcotics trafficking can't be sanctioned. What we're saying is that Tier 2 designation criteria under which Mr. Lopez has been designated is not the appropriate criteria to use in that case. The appropriate criteria would have been the 1904B4 criteria. And this makes even more sense because in 2007, OFAC—
Excuse me, counsel. I understand your point, and it makes me more— I hadn't thought about it, but it makes me wonder whether if your client got designated as an aider and abettor, would he be better off or worse off than being designated as a Tier 2?
Well, Your Honor, he would be better off because he would understand what he's actually dealing with. Now, the government's allegations here are that he's the chief money launderer for Tarek El Asami, but the designation criteria that he's been designated for is only for dealing with Tarek El Asami. So in going into the administrative process, should we be looking at his relationship with El Asami, or should we be looking at his relationship in narcotics trafficking more generally?
And would just be the informational? That's the only difference. I'm talking about consequences in terms of blocking. And while I'm on the subject, are there any forfeiture actions against your client?
There have been some forfeiture actions brought by third-party litigants who are holding judgments.
This is against, in the 11th Circuit?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor.
All right.
That's correct.
But nothing by the government itself?
Not that I'm aware of, but there is a criminal indictment which may have a forfeiture charge in it. I just don't have that indictment in front of me, Your Honor.
Okay.
And excuse me, Judge Henderson, please. Oh, there was no question. Just moving on quickly to the last point, we also took issue with the disclosures made to the appellant. The disclosures made are just not sufficient for purposes of due process. What we received, as the court, district court itself noted, was a heavily redacted administrative record that might itself not be adequate in order to provide notice to the appellant. We received a Federal Register notice that only provides the legal criteria for designation. And then the unclassified summaries we received from the government consisted of four sentences. Two of the sentences just characterize Mr. Lopez as a money launderer or business representative, don't describe conduct, and the others do not provide the where and the when of the allegations. I see my time is up, Your Honor. If there is any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Thank you, counsel. We'll give you a little bit of time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Hear from the government now. Mr. Schultz.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, Benjamin Schultz on behalf of the Office of Foreign Assets Control. The government in this case designated Mr. Lopez Bello because he was providing material support or was acting for on behalf of a significant foreign narcotics trafficker. And really, there's no dispute at this point that Mr. Lopez Bello was on notice of his own involvement with significant foreign narcotic trafficking. He was the chief money launderer for a major narcotics trafficker. So at this point, what his argument is really reducing to is the idea that even though he had notice of his own involvement in international narcotics trafficking, the government was somehow required to give him additional notice that it was going to target that particular trafficking network. And we submit that there's nothing in the Kingpin Act that requires that, and there's nothing in the Due Process Clause that requires that.
Suppose he didn't have that notice. Suppose he's a person who is providing assistance. You know, he's a travel intermediary or something like that, but he actually doesn't know anything about the underlying activities.
I think that's exactly what the OFAC delisting process is designed to deal with. Somebody who is totally caught up on this, completely unaware, I think their next step would be to file a delisting petition with OFAC. They would say, hey, I'm so sorry. I was providing services to this guy. No idea that he was involved in narcotics trafficking. Now that I know, I'm completely dissociating with him, and please unblock. And I think that person would have a pretty good case. And that's the delisting process is designed to accommodate people who are no longer a threat, no longer engaged in international narcotics trafficking.
And does it actually work out that way? Because that, the statute itself doesn't require delisting in that situation, as I understand it.
So the statute does give OFAC a lot of discretion, and you're right that there's no scienter requirement within the statute. And that part of the reason for that is because Congress's goal was to work really hard to disrupt these trafficking networks. The way that the OFAC regulations are written, and these delisting regulations actually predate the Kingpin Act. They're delisting regulations that apply across OFAC sanctions programs. They say that one of the things you can argue in a delisting petition is that the circumstances resulting in the designation no longer apply. And you have a pretty good argument if you say, hey, look, I'm not going to do this anymore. I didn't know before, and now I know. And obviously, there'd be credibility determinations. Maybe OFAC doesn't believe you, and you can have judicial review. But that, the way the process is designed to work is if that's really your situation, you're the kind of person who probably should be filing a delisting petition.
That's one more question about the government's interpretation of the statute. So this case involves one where there was a simultaneous designation.
Sure.
Could you make a designation of a Tier 2 person without having made the designation of the Tier 1 person?
So I think the way the statute is written, you have to be, if you're going to be a Tier 2, you have to be, you know, doing the material support or acting for on behalf of, it's, I think the statutory language is someone designated by OFAC. So you wouldn't necessarily have to be acting for on behalf of a Tier 1. You could be doing it on behalf of another Tier 2.
Right. So just, right. Thanks for the clarification. So I guess the question is, can you have a non-simultaneous designation? In other words, you designate somebody based on the fact that they're working with somebody else designated. And that could be either a Tier 1 or Tier 2 person. But that other person hasn't been identified yet.
So I'm not aware of any instance in which OFAC has tried to designate a Tier 2 based on material support for someone who has never been designated. Whether that is something that the statute permits, I think, is an interesting question. We have cited some cases in which this court has interpreted past tense adjectival phrases as including not just the past tense, but also the present and the future tense. And so, for example, there's that Rural Cellular case, which interpreted the phrase established by the agency. And this court upheld the agency's conclusion that established by the agency could include things that the agency establishes in the future. So that may well be something that OFAC has the statutory power to do. We're not in this case, invoking that potential argument. And all that we're saying here is, at the least, the statute permits simultaneous designation.
As far as you know, has OFAC ever invoked this statute to carry out a future, to bring somebody within the fold, but predicated on a future designation?
I am not aware of a future designation that OFAC has ever done under the Kingpin Act.
Is Mr. Lopez Bello still a fugitive?
My understanding is that he continues to be a fugitive from justice, and he has not yet stood trial in the Southern District of New York on his indictment.
Okay.
I do want to briefly respond to a point that I heard opposing counsel make about how we don't need to do these simultaneous designations because we could always just designate people under B4. If you turn to B4, when OFAC makes a designation under B4, OFAC has to conclude that the person plays a significant role in international narcotics trafficking. Now, I'm not sure if I'm hearing opposing counsel concede that Mr. Lopez's Bello's activities actually meet that standard, that it's not just that he's materially supporting another significant foreign narcotics trafficker, but that he himself is doing significant foreign narcotics trafficking. If that's his concession, then it almost seems like we've got harmless error here because the agency could have designated under B4 regardless of whether his interpretation is correct. But I think the important statutory point here is there are going to be some people who are doing material support or acting or on behalf of significant foreign narcotic traffickers, but their own behavior doesn't meet that significance test. And you know, historically, the way that OFAC has interpreted it, as you look at their designations over the years, it's usually, you know, you got the major central person or central group of people, and those get the significant designations under B4. And then you've got all the people who support them, and those tend to be the B2s and the B3s.
In a delisting administrative proceeding, who has the burden of proof?
I think that's an interesting question. I don't think OFAC's regulations discuss that. It might in part depend on the kind of claim that you're making. You know, sometimes people's argument is, you know, they're not presenting any proof of their own. They're just saying, OFAC, you don't have enough evidence. And then if OFAC rejects their petition, you know, you got arbitrary and capricious review, and then OFAC either did or didn't have enough evidence. Sometimes people are presenting their own evidence, and then it's just a question of, you know, you've got OFAC's evidence and you've got this person's evidence. OFAC makes a decision, and then this court reviews that under the arbitrary and capricious test. Unless there are further questions, I think we'll rest on our
base. I have one question, and that is, you just said that the tier two are for people who aren't that, who don't fit the significant. Why wouldn't a chief money launderer be a significant part of a drug trafficking?
Your Honor, it's possible that Mr. Lopez Bello could meet the B4, and if I'm hearing opposing counsel concede that the kind of conduct that OFAC concluded that Mr. Lopez Bello engaged in meets the significance test, then it sure seems like, why are we even here? Because it feels like this is harmless error because he could have been designated under B4. But there are going to be some people who are materially supporting tier ones who, for one reason or another, don't meet that significance test.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Ferrari, we'll give you 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just quickly, I'd like to touch on the administrative delisting petition process. As a lawyer who deals with that process every single day, the process is a years-long process. Most of the cases that we handle before the agency take anywhere from 2.5 to 3.5 or 4 years in some instances to resolve. Two, Judge Randolph brought up the burden of proof. The burden of proof in that regulation is on the person who is petitioning for delisting to assert that there's either an insufficient basis for the designation or assert the circumstances have changed. Mr. Schultz had mentioned credibility determinations. I think it's important to note oftentimes when a party is denied in that process, it is based on credibility determinations. And oftentimes what OFAC says to us is, well, we asked you a question in a questionnaire, which is whether you engage in narcotics trafficking. You said no, we have evidence of otherwise, therefore you haven't told us the truth and therefore your petition is denied. So, and touch upon this in our reply brief, but that process doesn't work here where you have a person who can avail themselves of constitutional protections, why they should have to wait several years to get that determination. Two, there was a question raised about whether tier twos can be designated after the tier one has been designated. Yes, and that's very common. We've seen that many times in practice. OFAC often does designate a tier one first and then build network by identifying tier two targets. And then with respect to the significant role, I just want to make clear, we are not conceding Mr. Lopez is involved in international narcotics trafficking at all. It may be possible that OFAC had evidence that he had some dealings with Mr. Elassami prior to the date of his designation. And that's why they chose the tier two designation as to a tier one designation. But the way they've trumped up the allegations here certainly seems to Judge Henderson's point, why wouldn't it be significant enough to designate him as a tier one? The government has not pointed out that you can't have simultaneous designations of tier ones who are working together in a narcotics trafficking organization. I see my rebuttal time is up, but happy to answer any.
I have one question for you. It may involve a couple. Do you believe that the comparable provisions in the Anti-Terrorism Act for listing foreign terrorist organizations are relevant to the arguments here?
I don't, Your Honor. And the reason why is because, one, that act was drafted before the Kingpin Act. It has some similar aspects to it, but that act has extraterritorial application. It deals with a whole different issue set than narcotics trafficking. There's both civil and criminal liability under that. There's review by Congress. There's a right to judicial review within the act itself. So I feel like it's a very different act, Your Honor.
Right. And well, you know, I suppose there's an argument that if the terrorist organization hasn't been designated, but you've given money to it in the past, you're not guilty of any kind of offense. And it just occurred to me that might support your position.
Your Honor, it may, and I can't comment on it because I haven't paid attention in preparing for this case for the designation criteria of that particular statute.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you to both counsel. We'll take this case under submission.